You're on. Good morning, everybody. I am going to try and do my own slides today. So if I forget, just shout at me if the wrong thing is on the screen. I'd love to share something today which really just came out of a word that Julian shared about a month ago now about tasting and seeing that the Lord is good. Which is a really good message. If you've not heard it, do check it out on the website. We've just finished a short series on revival, and we're into a series now looking at the grace of God. And so this is going to be a little bit of a combo message of trying to kind of mix the two things together a little bit and bring some of those themes that we were looking at when we looked at revival into a story which I think is also a story of incredible grace. And we're going to have a challenge and an encouragement. So a challenge and an encouragement. And I want us to look at the story of when God's people, Israel, were in the wilderness, and Moses was leading them. They had been taken out of slavery in Egypt, and they called out for food, and God provided food for them in the form of manna, this miraculous food that would appear every morning. And then they cried out for water, and God provided water miraculously from a rock. God provided for them with food and water. And yet the stories that we look for in terms of being hungry for God, that this isn't just a story from the Old Testament, a history story, that this is all over the scriptures. So just very quickly run through. We see in Psalm 42, as the deer pants for the streams of water, so my soul pants for you. My soul thirsts for God, for the living God. When can I go and meet with God? We see it in Psalm 63. You, God, are my God. Earnestly I seek you. I thirst for you. My whole being longs for you in a dry and parched land where there is no water. And we see this all over the teachings and the life of Jesus as well. So when Jesus' ministry starts, what's the first thing that he does? He goes into the wilderness and he fasts. And the first temptation that the enemy comes with him is to provide food. If you are the Son of God, tell these stones to become bread. Jesus answered, it is written, man shall not live on bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of God. And then you turn over the page and Jesus is teaching in the Sermon on the Mount. And he says, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for a right relationship with God, because they will be filled. And then you turn over the page again and you have the sermon, the Lord's Prayer. Give us our daily bread. Give us today our daily bread. And any Jew would have immediately thought of the manna, which was a daily provision of bread from God. And Jesus had these miracles where he would feed the people, feeding of the 5,000. And in John's gospel, he feeds the 5,000. And then it says the next day, the people come to him and Jesus calls them out because he says, you're not looking for me. You're just looking for your breakfast. You're looking for another. I've become a human vending machine. And you're just looking for your next meal. And he says, they said, well, our ancestors ate manna in the wilderness. He gave them bread to eat from heaven. And so Jesus says, look, I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me will never go hungry. Whoever believes in me will never be thirsty. And just a few chapters before that, Jesus has the woman at the well where he says, I will give you living water if you ask for it. You'll never be thirsty. And then I think almost the most remarkable example is in 1 Corinthians 10, where Paul writes this. I don't want you to be ignorant of the fact, brothers and sisters, that our ancestors were all under the cloud. They passed through the sea. They were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. They all ate the same spiritual food and drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank from the spiritual rock that accompanied them, and that rock was Christ. This story of provision in the desert, that it was actually Jesus providing for them, that these stories about hungering and thirsting actually point to a greater need that we have, a hunger and thirst for God. And this is what we do when we fast sometimes. We kind of submit our human need for food to our greater need for God. And if you're anything like me, I was fasting in the week, and you know, you go to the fridge and you think, oh no, yeah, I'm fasting. And you go back, and then you come back to the fridge and you think, oh no, yeah, I'm fasting. And you know, it's like you have to submit this desire for food to your greater desire, your kind of almost more important desire for God. No idea where we're up to on the slides. Oh yeah, that's an artist's impression of manna. It could be snow, but we'll pretend that it's manna. So I wanted to look at a story in Numbers 11. If you've got a Bible, you can read it. It'll come up on the screen as well. And this is where the people have been eating this manna for a while, and then they get fed up. And I just want to ask you this question before we read. What do you long for at the moment? And is God your greatest need? Is God your greatest need? So here we go. So this is Numbers 11, starting at verse 4. The rabble with them, that is with the crowd, began to crave other food. And again, the Israelites started wailing and saying, if only we had meat to eat. We remember the fish we ate in Egypt at no cost. Also the cucumbers, melons, leeks, onions, and garlic. But now we have lost our appetite. We never see anything but this manna. The manna was like coriander seed, and it looked like resin. The people went around gathering it and then ground it in a handmill or crushed it in a mortar. They cooked it in a pot or made it into loaves, and it tasted like something made with olive oil. When the dew settled on the camp at night, the manna also came down. Moses heard the people of every family wailing at the entrance to their tents. The Lord became exceedingly angry, and Moses was troubled. He asked the Lord, why have you brought this trouble on your servant? What have I done to displease you that you put the burden of all these people on me? Did I conceive these people? Did I give them birth? Why do you tell me to carry them in my arms as a nurse carries an infant to the land you promised on oath to their ancestors? Where can I get meat for all these people? They keep wailing to me, give us meat to eat. I cannot carry all these people by myself. The burden is too heavy for me. If this is how you're going to treat me, please go ahead and kill me right now if I have found any favor in your eyes, and do not let me face my own ruin. And so the story goes on. They call out for meat, and instead of meat, God gives them quail. This isn't like, you know, a nice tasty cut of sirloin steak. This is like a little kind of, I don't know not much about quail, but it doesn't look the most appetizing meat, if you ask me. They ask for meat, and God gives them meat. He provides for them with meat. I don't know if anyone has a little bit of doubt, like I do, about the selective memory that might be going on when they complain to God. Oh, we remember when we were slaves. Did the Egyptians really give their slaves the finest fresh fish, cucumbers and melons and leeks, all of these choice meat and vegetables? I suspect there might be a little bit of grass is greener on the other side going on here, a little bit of selective memory. But what's happened is that they have become complacent with God's provision. They become complacent with God's provision. Just as an aside here, it's worth noting that the context of this is spiritual apathy amongst the people, but also a breakdown amongst the leader. Moses has gone into a full breakdown at this point, and I just think it's worth, kind of as an aside, saying it's really important to look after and love your leaders. And I thought it was really good when we did that with Tom the other day, when he made his announcement. But it's important to do that for Julian as well, and I want to honor you, Julian, publicly. I think Moses just is an example here of real humility and leadership, and I think you really you demonstrate that, and you embody that incredibly well. So I just want to honor you for that as an aside. I also just think it's remarkable that we heard about Elijah the other day, and three of the prophets who are the most influential in the Old Testament, Moses, Elijah and Jonah all got to the point at one point or another of being suicidal, of being desperate and having nothing else in the tank, and of just basically saying, God, I can't do it anymore. And God, in their weakness and in their kind of lackingness, God meets them and so God uses them. So the challenge, I think, for us is, are you hungry for God? Or are there other things that have come in and taken that place? What does quail represent in the story? Quail represents anything that comes in to take our heart and our attention. It doesn't necessarily have to be the great big attention-grabbing thing, you know, this big sin over here. You know, it can be as innocuous as like a game on your phone that you download this game and you know, oh, I'm just a bit bored, play this game, it's fine, it's a bit of fun. And then over time you get more and more, you put more and more of your time into it, it gets more of your attention, more of your heart. Is this true for you? Seeing a reaction. But this is what, it's the innocuous stuff that comes in and that takes that place of God in our hearts. I don't think that the people were necessarily trying to push God away deliberately. They just became sick and tired of his provision, of his ordinary everyday grace to them. This is why gratitude is so important, because when we thank God for what we've got, it stops us getting to that place of complacency. This is kind of a bit of a negative example, I guess, of hungering for God. I want to give a couple of positive examples of what it looks like to be hungry for God. In my previous church, we met in a kind of public venue like this. And because it was like a community hall, it had all of these government, every government poster you could imagine was there. And they had one from the NHS on water. And somebody came and gave a word about it, and it's just stuck with me. It said, drink little and often throughout the day. Do not wait until you are thirsty. Do not wait until you're thirsty. And, you know, being thirsty is good, I guess. You know, we're talking about thirsting for God, but it's so much better when we're spending that time with God, little and often. We're bringing him into our everyday. Another example, Becky and I were having dinner the other day. We had a pork or something. It was a roast of some sort. And plenty of gravy, of course. And Becky had pretty much finished her meal, and there was a bit of gristle on the plate, but also all the leftover gravy was on the plate. And being the caring person that I am, I thought, I'll take that gristle and I'll just put it in the bin, and then I'll give the plate back so that she can enjoy her gravy. And I didn't communicate that, though. I just took it. And the look of disgust and horror and shock that came over Becky was, I'll never forget. And I learned at that moment, if I didn't know before, never come between a Yorkshire woman and her gravy.
Piece of bread on it.
Exactly. But, you know, to be hungry for God, to be indignant if we're robbed of that time in his presence, that we long for him. And the best example that you can have in Scripture is in Exodus 33. And it's what Moses used to do. He used to go out to the edge of the camp. And he used to pitch a tent, which he called the Tent of Meeting. And he used to go out there with his assistant, Joshua. And it says this. As Moses went into the tent, the pillar of cloud would come down and stay at the entrance while the Lord spoke with Moses. Verse 10. Whenever the people saw the pillar of cloud standing at the entrance of the tent, they all stood and worshipped, each at the entrance of their tent. The Lord would speak with Moses face to face as one speaks with a friend. That's intimacy. That's the intimacy that we get when we come into his presence, that we can talk to him face to face like someone speaks with a friend. But alongside that, there's also this little detail which I love. Then Moses would return to the camp, but his young assistant, Joshua, son of Nun, did not leave the tent. And that's desperation. I love that. That even when Moses has packed it in, even when Moses has had enough, that Joshua is still, I just want a bit more. just a bit more, just another 5 minutes. And intimacy and desperation is what we combine when we come to God in prayer, in the tent of meeting. And I challenge, do you have a tent of meeting, a place to go and meet with God, to go and be with him? I love that phrase, just 5 more minutes. It's like if you've got kids, right, and you're trying to put them to bed, and some of you know what I'm talking about, but it's like if they're playing a game or something, and it's like, oh no, just another 5 minutes, I just need to get onto this level. And then it's like, no, just another 5 minutes, I'm nearly there. And 5 becomes 10, becomes 15, becomes 20. And it's like, do we hunger for God? Just another 5 minutes. You know, it's really good we've got kids workers, it's really good to relieve the kids workers on a Sunday, and we've got, you know, we need to shut stuff down, it's really good to be out in time. It's good to finish on time. There's something in our hearts, though, that can happen where we think, oh, you know, sermon's been going on for a while, isn't it? And or, you know, oh, we've sung this chorus through a few times already, you know, can we go on to the next song, or whatever it might be. And do we have that heart that just says, oh, just another 5 minutes? I just want to be in your presence. I love the story that Mark shared of the guy from Lewis in the Hebridean revival, who at the end of the service just prayed for 45 minutes, crying out to God for his friends who didn't know Jesus. And then as time went on, the church began to fill and people started coming from their homes in the middle of the night to join. And it started just with that place of desperation, just that tent of meeting. How do we put this into practice? Well, if only someone had organized specifically a whole week of prayer meetings out of the goodness of their heart, prayer meetings that you could attend from the comfort of your own home. I just bumped up the attendance a little bit there, Julia. But, you know, isn't that like an obvious expression of that? And I don't, you know, there's no judgment. I've sometimes had to work and I can't make them. But, you know, just encourage you to come and to pray and to seek God over ourselves, but also over others. I love that phrase from Psalm 42. When can I go to be with God? And for me, practically, what it's been the last few years, especially since lockdown, is just go for a walk in the park with my headphones, and I got my worship music on, and I just go around the North Inch usually, and like that's just my little time with God. And God has spoken to me really powerfully at times through that. At times I've read the Bible and it's been so encouraging, or I've come to God with a problem and he's met me in that place. But, you know, like it's not just on a Sunday. One thing that I used to do in my old work, which is I just found really useful, was, you know, if you go to the toilet and then you've got to come out and you're so busy, you're on to the next thing, and the next thing is, you know, go to the toilet, wash your hands, and then before going out, just take 2 minutes just to pray over the people that you're around or the situations that you're in. And I think people probably thought I had some kind of bowel issue at one point because I'd been in the toilet for so long. But, you know, like just taking 2 minutes to pray for what's going on around you and for those situations. So I challenge you to have a tent of meeting, to be with God. And if there's quail, if there's stuff which you're longing for, which maybe doesn't satisfy, because the quail, they got the quail. They got more quail than they knew what to do with. And then it decayed and it started going off. And it started causing a problem in the camp because they couldn't get rid of it. You know, that's the thing, when we hunger for things which aren't God, it can't fill that void that we have. Hunger for God. So that's the challenge, to be hungry for God. There's also an encouragement, and we'll go back to Numbers 11. I love this bit of the story. So Numbers 11 and starting verse 16. So Moses has had his kind of crisis and he calls out to God, and then it says, "The Lord said to Moses, bring me 70 of Israel's elders who are known to you as leaders and officials among the people. Make them come to the tent of meeting, that they may stand there with you. I will come down and speak with you there. I'll take some of the power of the Spirit that is on you and put it on them, and they will share the burden of the people with you so that you won't have to carry it alone. And then Moses has another kind of freak out moment where he says, where am I going to get all this meat from? And then skipping forward to verse 24. Moses went out and told the people what the Lord had said. He brought together 70 of their elders and made them stand round the tent. The Lord came down in the cloud and spoke with him, and he took some of the power of the Spirit that was on him and put it on the 70 elders. When the Spirit rested on them, they prophesied, but they did not do so again. However, two men, whose names were Eldad and Medad, had remained in the camp. They were listed among the elders, but they did not go out to the tent. Yet the Spirit also rested on them, and they prophesied in the camp. A young man ran and told Moses, Eldad and Medad are prophesying in the camp. Joshua, son of Nun, who had been Moses' assistant since youth, spoke up and said, Moses, my Lord, stop them. But Moses replied, are you jealous for my sake? I wish that all of the Lord's people were prophets and that the Lord would put his Spirit on them. Then Moses and the elders of Israel returned to the camp. If we're going to look at grace, isn't that just a sign of God's grace? The two guys who weren't even at the meeting also get filled with the Spirit. You know, these are the two guys who the alarm goes off on Sunday morning and they're going, nah, I just don't feel like it today. Roll over and go back to sleep. And then wake up at 11:15 and go, oh, I'm leading the service today. I'm late, I'm preaching today. And, you know, they're putting their clothes on and the shoes on and the jacket and running out the door, and suddenly they start to feel a bit strange. And suddenly they start to speak with God's Spirit. That God's Spirit comes upon them, not just on the 68. If I was Moses, I would probably do a roll call of the people who were there and be, okay, who's here? Okay. We've got 68 people. Okay, who's missing? Okay, we've got Eldad and Medad. Okay, well, we'll just wait for them. And, you know, just we'll just take a moment to see if they're coming, see if they're running stuck in traffic or something. And then after 5 minutes, we'll be like, has anyone got Eldad and Medad's number? Okay. And then, you know, if I was God, maybe I'd just be like, well, we've got 68. That's still pretty good. We'll fill the 68. But it's the grace of God. He also fills the two people who weren't even there. You know, this is the most significant meeting of Eldad and Medad's life. If there was one thing to get to and to be on time for, this was it. And they missed the boat. We don't know why. We don't know what's happened that means that they missed it. Something has, you know, there's something about them that they've been picked out as elders of the people. But for whatever reason, they weren't at the meeting. Maybe you've come to church today and you don't feel particularly close to God. Maybe you've come here a little bit on autopilot. Maybe you've come here today and you feel like actually you've been hungering for the quail rather than for God. This is the grace of God. He longs for us to hunger for him, to thirst for him, but he also comes near to those people who don't hunger for him and who don't thirst for him. And he comes and meets those people and he fills them too. And God can fill you with his Spirit. He can speak through you as he spoke through Eldad and Medad. And isn't this what happens in revival? I'm very kind of well versed on revival. I feel like I've learned a lot from the series that we've had. But it's that God doesn't just meet his people in the tent of meeting. He also meets them in the camp. That God doesn't just meet his people in the churches, as great as that is, as wonderful as that is, but he also goes to the camp and he fills his people in the camp. That God would meet his people in the streets and in the pubs and in the shops, as well as in the churches. And just as we come to an end, I've got a kind of secondary challenge, which is from Moses' reaction. because Moses is completely relaxed about this outbreak of the spirit in the camp. Joshua's reaction is to shut it down, and just for context, this is not this is pre-Pentecost. This is pre the cross. So a holy God going into the midst of the unholy people was actually pretty scary. And so Joshua's response is, we need to shut this down. This isn't safe. You know, when the law was given on Mount Sinai, they actually put a security cordon around the mountain to stop people going so near, because that was the extent of the glory and the power of God. And yet Moses sees this happening, and he's like, well, I just want all of the people to be filled with the Spirit. I want all of the people to be prophets. It's not about me. If God brings revival and Dundee gets blessed, or Stirling gets blessed, or Inverness gets blessed, or Edinburgh gets blessed, or other churches in Perth get blessed, do we rejoice over what God's doing? Or do we go, ugh, why can't God do that here? Moses is humble. He's servant leadership. He doesn't see having the Spirit as a kind of, other people having the Spirit as a kind of threat. I want to give a couple of stories which just put skin on the bone of this. I've been listening to some sermons from Pete Gregg's church and just encouraged by a couple of the stories just to share. There's a guy who's a British Iranian, and he helps the church in Iran quite a lot. And he's got this amazing story of there's a guy called Razul, who's an Iranian Christian, but he lives in America. And he's encouraged us to phone people in Iran and share the gospel with them. So he phones up this guy that he was at school with. And this guy says, oh, no, I'm not really that interested, but you can phone my son. His son left home when he was 14, went to live on the streets, and got involved in drugs, got involved in crime, just, you know, got to a completely low point living on the streets of Tehran by himself. That he's now 20, 21. And so he gets this phone call, and he hears the gospel, and he responds, and he gives his life to Jesus. This is in an Islamic country. And so they think, okay, we've got to get him his first Bible. So you can't just go to your local Christian bookshop. You can't just go on the internet and order one. So they've got to smuggle a Bible in, and they don't even say, we want you to go to a certain house. They say, well, we'll tell us where you live, and we'll find a local park, a bench, or a bin, or a lamppost, or we'll hide it behind that. We'll take a photo, and then you go and you can pick it up. And it'll be like a different place each time. So they say, where do you want us to hide your Bible? He says, well, just somewhere in North Tehran, which would be like saying somewhere in North Glasgow. They're like, oh, are you sure? Like, that's quite a big area. It's like, oh, yeah, just leave it. I'll find it. So they find a random bench, leave it under the bench, and take a photo. And he gets this photo, and he phones up the guy, and he says, why have you sent me this photo? Why have you sent me this photo of this random bench in Tehran? And they said, well, remember, we're going to hide a Bible, and that's where we're going to leave it. Yeah, but why have you sent me this photo? Well, remember, the Bible, we've hidden the Bible for you. And he keeps asking this question, and I think, this guy's like not getting it at all. And he says, you seriously don't know? This was the bench that I spent 4 years on, sleeping on the streets when I was 14 years old. Out of all of the benches of North Tehran, you've picked this bench, and this is the bench where I've got to go and pick up my Bible and have the presence of God. Isn't that just God's kindness? Isn't that amazing? Just one more. This is like from the last couple of years. This isn't like from years ago. There's a guy called Sean in England, and he's a tiler. And during the first lockdown, he has this dream of Jesus. You hear about people in the Middle East having dreams, but this guy in England has a dream of Jesus. Jesus just walks up the stairs, puts a hand on his shoulder, and says, I've got you. And he just feels this wave of love pouring out from Jesus. Never been to church, no connection with church at all. And he wakes up, and he realizes he doesn't want to look at porn anymore. And he stops swearing. He didn't realize that there's anything wrong with swearing. And he's, you know, this change has happened on him. But he also has this big decision to make. Fast forward a few months. He has arthritis, really bad arthritis in his knee. And so he's obviously quite physical, doing tiling. long waiting lists on the NHS. And so someone approaches him and says, do you want to set up a new shop, a tiling shop? It would mean you wouldn't have to go out to people's houses anymore. And he says, well, you know, it'd be really, really good in a lot of ways, but then it's a big risk to take. A lot of businesses are shutting down with COVID. And, you know, is this the right time to be making this big decision? And so his wife says, well, why didn't you ask Jesus? You know, what you had this vision of Jesus, remember? Why didn't you ask Jesus? So they ask Jesus, not really knowing what to expect. And he's at work one day in someone's house. There's no one around him, no radio on. And he hears a voice, an audible voice, that says a word that he's never heard before, which is Corinthians. And he doesn't know anything about the Bible or anything, but he knows that there are these tiles called Corinthian tiles. But he's like, is there something to do with Corinthian tiles? Like, what's going on? But he's got this bit of wall, so he writes Corinthians, because he knows he's going to tile that bit up. And then he hears the word seven. And then he hears the word 26. And this is like so far out there that you're like, this is crazy. But like, what motivations does this guy have to make it up? He's not even a Christian at this point. So he takes he writes it on the wall, takes a photo, sends it to his wife. And he comes home at the end of the day, what's all this stuff about? I've been hearing this voice. And so she said, I think that's the Bible. I think that might be the Bible. So they look up 1 Corinthians 7:26. Which have all of the verses in all of Scripture that he could have got. It's the most amazing verse. It's completely out of context because it's all about marriage in context. But this is what it says, 1 Corinthians 7:26. Because of the present crisis, I think that it is good for a man to remain as he is. Because of the present crisis, I think that it is good for a man to remain as he is. And there's like, this is Jesus speaking to people who aren't even close to him, who aren't even Christians, with such incredible precision and intimacy and power. Isn't this what happens when God pours out his Spirit? Isn't this what happens in revival? It's a challenge to hunger and thirst for God, to have intimacy and desperation. Encouragement is that God is a God of grace, who meets us where we are, who meets us where we are, who speaks to us even when we don't seek him. And if you are feeling, if you're not feeling particularly hungry or thirsty this morning, I'd just say don't beat yourself up for that. There's this great prayer from St. Augustine that says, put salt on our mouths that we may thirst for you. If you're not thirsty, you can ask God to put salt on your mouth that you might thirst for him. I'm just going to pray for us as we finish. God, we thank you that you're a God of grace. You know every detail of our lives, Lord. And you can speak to people in, on the streets of Tehran or Tyler's, Lord, in England. And you can speak to anyone, Lord. You're a God of grace. Lord, when we've been longing for quail and meat and things which aren't of you, Lord, just pray that you'd, in this moment, that we would put those things down, put those things aside. And say, I want the spiritual food that satisfies. We want more of you, Lord. Give us a hunger and a thirst for you, Lord. Lord, if we're not thirsty, would you put salt on our lips that we may thirst for you? just want to encourage you in this quietness just to do your own business with God. If there's something you want to say to him, then speak it out to him.